my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show, conversations with people at the leading edge. I'm Paula. In the 1830s, Oberlin College was an early leader, providing higher education to all men, including African Americans, and to women. Oberlin's 14th president, Marvin Krisloff, says education should teach its students the application of well-founded critical thinking rather than the recitation of facile answers.
The quality of your questions and the quality of the answers that you try to provide is what's important. It's not necessarily getting the right answer. And in my teaching, one of the things I try to do are structure problems that don't have answers. And to say, it's okay if you don't have a clear-cut answer, but it's important for you to show me that you're thinking about it in a methodical way. You're looking at data or evidence or whatever it is that in your discipline, and that you're thinking through those things, and you also can identify how you might further explore it outside of the context of whatever problem or project we're working on. And it's hard because I don't think that we necessarily give that message to young people, and it is a very rush culture, and the pace, I mean, it's very fast, and what we're talking
about, and we're really tempted to the easy answers and orthodoxy and the dogmatic.
Well, and it saves time. It saves time, and time is our most valued commodity. But I think it's important for us who are in positions to teach or to inspire, to say that it's okay to take a little bit longer, and it's okay to acknowledge difficulty, and it's okay to acknowledge that we don't have it right. And so one of the things I try to do is tell students, I don't know the answer to this, and that's okay. And probably you shouldn't feel that you know the answer either. You should be grappling with it. You should be working at it. I should see you struggling. And that's the way that we show that there's something important going on.
President of Oberlin since 2007, Marvin Krisloff had been vice president and general counsel at the University of Michigan. There, he successfully led the defense of that university's affirmative action program before the United States Supreme Court. Mr. Krisloff is a Rhodes Scholar and a graduate of the Yale Law School. Bill Russell and I have enjoyed getting to know Mr. Krisloff. This conversation was the beginning. Marvin Krisloff, president of Oberlin College, I've had a lifelong love affair with democracy. I just think it's a great idea. One of the things that people may tire of hearing about the Founding Fathers, but I've been really struck coming back as an adult, and I'm a government major at Oberlin College myself, fair disclosure here. John Adams understood that if you don't educate people, you can't have a democracy. That if you haven't had that key element that is education, forget it, because the it becomes mobocracy instead of democracy. You think that's right?
Well, I think it's essential, and one of the things that we really try to do at Oberlin College is give people a well-rounded education, what we would call a liberal arts education, and so people study a variety of disciplines, everything from sciences and arts and humanities, and I think that there's really a strong reason why in today's changing world, it's even more important to understand the way things interrelate and interconnect. And you know, so if we're thinking about the Middle East, for instance, it's important to understand the roots in religion and history and art, as well as politics and economics. And I also think it's really important that students get exposed to varying viewpoints. And that's something that I know, I teach as well, and I try to introduce varying viewpoints into the classroom as well, because I think it's important for students to understand that, you know, they're going to confront different people, different points of views, both internationally and domestically, and that if they can do it in a safe place, which is what college should be, it's a safe place to explore and to test ideas. That is one of the greatest opportunities that college in those 4 years presents. So we really like to challenge students, and the students at Oberlin actually are very challenging and intense and strong-minded people, and that's all the more fun. So
when you say what it is you teach.
Well, I teach a course on, it's a politics course, but it's on race and religion in the public schools. And so we talk about everything from Brown v. Board of Ed to busing, to affirmative action, to some of the movements now in terms of vouchers and magnet schools and so forth. That's in the race area. And then in religion, we think about everything, including what religious practices can be explored within a classroom, What kind of aid can be given to schools? Again, vouchers issues. In religion, it's very interesting because I find the students come to religion with very unformed ideas about the role religion plays in American life. And, you know, many of the students have gone to parochial schools, some have gone to secular, probably the majority to secular, but it's very interesting, and the dialogue...
And you're trained as a lawyer, so...
And I'm trained as a lawyer, and I like to make them challenge each other, and we do hypotheticals and scenarios, and right now we're doing the final exam. I think this will be after the final exam, so it's all right to talk about the final exam.
I won't tell.
That's all right. The final exam is a take-home exam, so they know it already. But it's based on real cases where certain universities have enacted anti-discrimination rules, including anti-discrimination protection against because of sexual orientation. And so the question is whether the Christian Legal Society in this instance could have its student registration or its organizational status within the university revoked because they wanted to exclude people who are actively gays.
And the answer is?
The answer is it's really a great question. And that's what makes it a great final exam. There are two answers, and the students, some of them say, I read one thing, and I think one, and I read another thing, and I sit and I think another, and it's really hard. And I said, that's the point. That's why we call it education.
Exactly.
And testing the ideas. And they're trying to role play for the current Supreme Court, and so they have to take their ideas and try to channel them through those 9 Supreme Court justices. But
fabulous.
But that's
a liberal education.
That's right. And we want them to understand that these are difficult questions, and it's okay to see that they're difficult questions. In fact, that's good. That means they're thinking, and that's part of what we're trying to do.
I watched you doing this, read this, and I remember that famous story about somebody who said, just give me a one-handed lawyer. I do not want any more of this on the one hand, on the other hand.
However, this one hand...
Well, let me say, it matters because we do want a one-handed lawyer. We want the answer. It's just, it's human nature, I think, and life does not lend itself to that kind of simple, cartoonish understanding.
And I think the best teachers and the best advocates are people who understand both hands, if you will, to carry out this metaphor, because they can be more effective when they take one point of view because they've anticipated what the weak points are and what the other side's arguments are. And you know, some of the students haven't been exposed to that method as much. But by the time they're seniors, we hope that they will have gotten used to this notion of multiple points of view and that they can really argue both sides. And sometimes we do things where we assign them roles that cut against their natural predilections. And I think that's fun and exciting as well.
And he thinks many things as the president at Oberlin College. Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon, Marvin Krisloff. We'll be back in just a moment. We hope you'll be too. Welcome back. This is the Paula Gordon Show. I'm Paula, Bill Russell, and President Marvin Krisloff. I can't go any farther without talking about this lawyer part, because I am thrilled that not only are you the president of Oberlin College, but you also come with your own wonderful education and your exciting experience as a lawyer at the University of Michigan, which I think is one of those lovely little nodes in your own life network. It's very important what you and the University of Michigan did for us in our democracy in defending the right to have affirmative action, the right to have affirmative action, and to think carefully about who gets educated in America. Wasn't that thrilling?
Well,
and hard.
It was a great honor for me to be part of the University of Michigan during that period in time. And as you know, what happened was we were sued. We at the University of Michigan were sued because of our admissions policy, which considered many, many different factors, primarily academic, but also geography, socioeconomic status, and so forth. But the piece we were sued about was the fact that there was some consideration of racial and ethnic diversity in order to try to get a critical mass of underrepresented minorities. And this was a policy that had been in effect for a very long time, And
reflected a lot of different people across the country. It wasn't like you did something weird.
No, in fact, after the Bakke case, which was 1978, most American universities and colleges implemented affirmative action programs that have been based on what was called the so-called Harvard Plan, where race and ethnicity was one plus factor, in addition to things like geography and socioeconomic status and so forth. And there was a challenge, a legal challenge to our policies as well as others, but ours were the ones that went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And one of the things that we did that I'm very proud of is we made a case about the importance of diversity in terms of achieving educational excellence, and that this exposure, similar to what we were just talking about, exposure to multiple points of view, including people from different racial and ethnic backgrounds, was very much a part of the educational experience and valuable for people from all backgrounds. And it was very compelling to the court. One of the things that they were very compelled by, the majority anyway, was the voices of the business community that said it was very important for business and economics to have perspectives and to be able to have interaction with people from different backgrounds. And one of the amicus briefs, friend of the court briefs, was actually submitted by a lot of military and military brass, including people like Norman Schwarzkopf, just to name drop. And they said that the military, after the Vietnam experience, where there had been this disconnect between the enlisted folks and the officers on racial grounds, the military had begun a very conscious effort to integrate the officer corps, and that was partly done in their academies and partly done through ROTC as well. And so the military programs were very similar to the affirmative action programs. They were affirmative action programs seen at most of our nation's leading colleges and universities. And I think the court found this very compelling because the academies are similar to colleges and universities because they're national groups, elite, selective leadership training, and it is, as you suggested, so important for democracy to have this kind of integrated leadership and an integrated educational experience, if at all, you know, if at all possible. And so this was a wonderful opportunity for me to be part of a historic moment. I think there are many other issues that still remain, and I think that one thing that we need to remember is affirmative action is really a very limited tool. It helps highly qualified people get into some of the elite schools, and it does produce some of our nation's greatest thinkers and leaders and so forth, but it is not a major social uplift program. It is really taking people who are very capable and giving them that extra opportunity, and to do so in an educational setting.
Listening to you, it brings me to the subject of justice, which is ultimately what this has to be about, the case has to be about. And justice has to do with opportunity more broadly. Justice has to go, at least socially, beyond what the letter of the law and even the intent of the law. And it seems that in that context, the role of the university or the college becomes very important because we would like to believe that everybody in the community has comparable opportunities. And of course, one of the arguments for affirmative action is that historically and currently has not been the case. And in some ways, it is to me a wonderful example of the richness and complexity that the role of these institutions of higher learning, in some ways even more important than the primary and secondary schools, in some ways much less important, but those roles as exemplars, as laboratories, as vehicles for experimenting, for thinking through how we're going to grow and evolve into a more just society, a freer society, a more democratic society. Not to put all the burden on you, but it is, isn't it? Isn't that your job?
Well, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this because this year in particular was a very competitive year for college admissions.
This was the year 2007-8, looking toward the class that starts 2008 and is the class of 2012?
It would be the starting in the fall of 2008, and so it would be the class of 12.
See, I got there. 12, I got there.
12. I wasn't a math major. But it would be the class of 2012.
I was pretty proud, and I'd already done my fingers and toes.
There you
so.
Go. That's why you're the host, and I'm just the guest. But this was a big, this is the baby boom echo. So mm-hmm. many people applying. And so we, along with most colleges and universities, selective colleges and universities, had record number of applications. And when you're making these choices, you are making very difficult decisions because you look at whole people and you're trying to merit is of course academic merit and potential is the most important thing, but you're also trying to get a class full of people who will be interesting and who will learn from each other, international. You want people who are studying different topics. You want some who are athletic. You want some people who are more artistic. And you want some people who are just all around good people and student leaders and so forth.
And what you decide makes a huge difference in their lives.
Absolutely, because there's the educational experience, which is transformative, which exposes people to different disciplines and so forth. But frankly, these colleges and universities are also part of networks. And we need to be realistic that this is part of the value of the education experience at this level is the networks of people, people like yourself, who one becomes part of that family when one goes to a place like an Oberlin or whatever selective school that you're at. And not just a selective school, but,
exactly.
but selective schools have been a conduit to access and to power. And if we look at, for instance, our presidential candidates on the Democratic side, for instance, both of those candidates went to highly selective schools and law schools. And you look in the lists of judges and senators and congresspeople and so forth, and disproportionately, those folks have gone to schools that are selective, and they can be public selective or private selective, but they are selective schools by and large, and that's why people are very anxious for their children and their grandchildren, because they know there is an impact, and it can be measured in economic terms of going to these places. I think,
and tremendous social terms as well as the economic,
right? Because
it shapes where we're going to go.
Well, and a lot of times you meet your spouse or partner at places like this, and so forth. So, the education itself is transformative, but the world of connections and family mm-hmm. and friends that you become part of is also incredibly important.
Which is why we want those institutions to be broadly representative.
Absolutely.
Because if these elites, and that's what you're talking about, do not have experience with a much richer world than having grown up typically in an elite environment, unless we're very careful, mm-hmm. And gone to an elite school and have friends who were comparably, blessed, then there is...
You end up with an aristocracy.
Well, you end up with an aristocracy, but it's an ignorant. It is a socially, culturally ignorant aristocracy, and you end up with, God help us, a governing class mm-hmm. that has no visceral understanding of the governed, which in a democracy is a very dangerous thing.
When it is the governed who are supposed to be in charge.
Well, and the mobility that education, and particularly higher education, gives is so important to American democracy. And I can tell you that Oberlin College, which is where I am now president, has had a long tradition of providing that access. And of course, we were the first college to open our doors to people regardless of races and to women in a coeducational environment. And that commitment is very deep and very strong.
And goes back to 1835. 175 years is
That's
a pretty
right.
good track record.
Right. We're celebrating our 175th anniversary this year. I'm very proud of that. And our commitment is backed up by a lot of money and resources. And so we continue to give very generous financial aid packages to people from lower and middle class families. And we reach out, and this year we've announced an initiative to eliminate loans for those students from Pell-eligible families. So these are families on the neediest side.
And eliminate the loans by giving support.
Giving them money, flat-out money.
Yeah.
And we have a very strong record of providing access to Pell-eligible families and families who are working class but not quite eligible for Pell as well. It's incredibly important. And, you know, there are so many steps of the way that as we see the opportunity, it's important to help students from less affluent families get access to the educational opportunities, to internships, to graduate and professional schools. And so what Oberlin and schools like Oberlin can do is really provide an enormous opportunity, not just for one particular person, but really for a whole family. And I'm so... That's one of the things that really makes my heart
sing. I'm excited about it because I was one of those kids. And where were you when I needed... Well, somebody was there because I was able to have that experience. We're going to be back in just a moment with President Marvin Krisloff, Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon. We trust that you'll be with us. We are delighted to be with President Marvin Krisloff from Oberlin College, who has had vast experience in lots of different places. Bill Russell, I am Paula Gordon, and you haven't had much chance here.
I want to go back to affirmative action, because people have a fairly parochial view of that, and I am a, confessions of a an affirmative action baby. I am confident, I know. I went to Stanford as essentially under an affirmative action.
He had all the grades, he had all the points, and...
Well, I was a Southerner, and Stanford didn't have a lot of Southerners. Yep. And for all I have some quarrels with the institution now and again, I am deeply appreciative of that perspective. And what they were looking for was geographic diversity at a time when that was not as as common as it is now. But there were kids that were better qualified, that had better scores across the board than I did, in California particularly, better school systems.
Mm-hmm.
And they made allowance for the fact that there's more to education and to potential than the high school that you happen to be afflicted with, or the grades or the scores on test. So this is not the simple stereotype that we tend to think of. This is a much richer idea and notion, and again, it's very important to a sense of fairness. Justice may be too big a word, of fairness in the overall community.
Well, and I didn't say lightly that I too had Oberlin in my case not looked through some of those. But I didn't have the grades that Bill had, and Oberlin could see something. The idea that we must be nurturing more than just this tiny elite that can afford it, that something. I know that your excitement, both about the ability to be reaching beyond the norm, if you will, and this access to education that has been a great block for just tons of people, that has to be thrilling.
It's absolutely thrilling. And, you know, I have a similar story because I grew up in Lexington, Kentucky, and although I did reasonably well, I was not... as well prepared and probably not as obviously credentialed as some people who may have been rejected. But one thing I did have is I had the passion and the desire, and it took me about a year and a half. But by that point, I think that my potential had been released, and I was able to do quite well. But it was hard. And one of the things that we as a college try to do, and we as a nation need to do, is to try to reach that potential in many, many people. And unfortunately, that's sometimes difficult to see, particularly if it's in a high school that is not so well known or is not so successful, at least from outward appearances. One of the things that I'm very proud of what Oberlin does is we have made a commitment to our local public schools. And one of the things we do is that any student who graduates there who's academically prepared gets a full free ride scholarship 4 years.
Fabulous. That's a new thing.
Which is enormous, an enormous opportunity. And in fact...
Because Oberlin is a very poor little town in its own way.
Right. There are many people there who do not have the kind of money to afford to pay the tuition without that kind of scholarship. And in fact, there's a really wonderful story. A young woman who lived in the surrounding area knew that she wanted to go to Oberlin, was attracted to the college, and asked her family to move to the town so that she could go to the high school and then could become eligible. And she's done that. She's very accomplished, and she's going to Oberlin next year. And, you know, it's just
That's
a wonderful
great.
Story.
Well, and of, all of that that northeastern part of Ohio, where Oberlin is in a swamp, I'm proud to say, having grown up next to a cattail marsh swamp, so I don't say that idly, that's the Rust Belt. You're not talking about Cambridge here. You're talking about Northeast Ohio. And we haven't even mentioned that you have a world-renowned school of music as well. The conservatory enriches all of this in wonderful ways.
Absolutely. The conservatory has spawned some of the greatest leaders in music, including Atlanta's own Robert Spano and Alison Voldemort at the Atlanta Symphony, and many, many others. I just mentioned those.
You just happen to be here.
Because I'm in Atlanta, and they're very much on my mind. So thank you, Robert and Alison, for being wonderful Oberlin alums. But we offer something like 500 performances a year on Oberlin's campus, and the vast majority of them are free. And
music is a really important part of that experience. Even if, like me, you were in the library instead of in the concert hall listening, the very fact that music is honored as part of this liberal arts education, and you have the Allen Art Museum, which is world class.
Absolutely.
All of these pieces, yes, I know I sound like I am doing a commercial for Oberlin College. I don't mean that. I really don't mean that. What I mean to say is, all of these elements, wherever they are found, are essential to a rich, full life where democracy can flourish and people can reach their full potential.
Right. And one of the things I also should mention that we're working on is really, Oberlin was recognized earlier this year by Sierra Club magazine as the number one coolest, meaning ecologically minded, school. And it is very important. We've been pioneers in the field of sustainability. Professor David Orr, who started our environmental studies program and is still very active at the school and a leader. We have the Adam Joseph Lewis Center, which is an iconic building which produces more energy than it uses. And it's a place where school children from all over the country come to see what we call the living machine. And we're looking at in enhancing our commitment to sustainability. We have a lot of locally grown food because there are farms in the area. And we do a lot of things with bikes and car sharing and trying to become carbon neutral. And that's a pledge that we have made. We were one of the first schools to make. So the sustainability and the connection between the town and the gown in terms of thinking about Oberlin as a model for a sustainable way of life is also very important to us and to the student body.
I have said to Professor Orr, and I don't say this lightly, that he is in many ways the Charles Finney of our time. Now, Charles Finney was a long time ago, 1835, but the passion at that time was around slavery and abolition, and Oberlin was all over that, and it was a very important, though small, part of a larger movement. And the environmental movement now is really a profound echo, in my opinion, of those liberation issues around bondage. And as we look forward, and David Orr is really eloquent talking about the bondage that we are imposing on those that come after us, if we're not right this moment being responsible on environmental issues. So this is not just, oh, and it's nice to be green, this isn't greenwash, oh, everybody's doing it. This is important stuff.
Absolutely, and it's doing it in a way that really is trying to involve the whole community. One of the things
you mean, the Oberlin itself,
the town, as well as the student body and the campus. And one of the things that I find particularly energizing about this is that the students are really driving a lot of these initiatives. So we just had the Echo Olympics to coincide with the Beijing Olympics, and the students had a dorm competition to see who can reduce the consumption. And they have these little orbs that I don't have it right in front of me, of course, but it showed whether or not people were using a lot of energy or they were reducing. And we're trying to
monitor. Is this a technical thing?
Yeah,
this orb?
It's an orb. It's an orb. And it flashes different colors, and red, I guess, is if you're using too much. And,
that's great.
And, you know, some sort of other color if you're being frugal.
I'll bet it would
frugal.
Be green.
Green, presumably. Yes.
Just a guess.
Yes, I'm a little colorblind. I have a red-green deficiency. So these color things.
I don't want to know this.
TMI, I understand. But anyway, they had these orbs, and there was a competition. And this is the kind of thing that the students are doing all the time to try to.
But you have something called
themselves.
A seed house.
Oh, yes. We have a seed house, and my 7-year-old daughter and I went to visit. They're taking an older house on the campus perimeter, and that was a combination of periphery and perimeter, and they're living there, and they're trying to reduce things like energy consumption and working on a garden and so forth. And again, this is all trying to create a model community in a way that not only, you know, one house in Oberlin, but as it spreads, as the idea spreads, in the Adam Joseph Lewis building, the idea has spread and been replicated and looked at by many, many other people internationally. the idea of trying to create this model of sustainable living that can be looked at by other communities, and we hope to make an influence on the world.
Your orb brings up an interesting notion to me. Metrics are very important. The orb is useful because it's a shorthand way of saying I'm winning, I'm losing. Mm. You know, sort of like a speedometer.
Is that like a one-handed lawyer?
No, it's different.
Sorry.
It's how you know whether the one-handed lawyer is giving you good advice.
I see.
But this, the notion of metrics more generally, and it goes back to what you were talking about, admissions. Mm-hmm. You know, what are the criteria? And frequently we get trapped into very stupid metrics. Mm. You know, sometimes there are things that can be red or green. You know, yeah. They're essentially binary.
Yeah.
Red and or you can get sophisticated, red, green, and yellow, you know, partway there. There are other things that the variables, the number of variables is so much richer. And I go back to this admissions challenge. How do you decide? What are the criteria? And it used to, in the old days, it was, it was birth. Mm. In a newer incarnation, it was test scores and GPAs. And then we started getting a little smarter about it. But it seems to me one of the challenges, both within the local community, you know, how do you know you're succeeding with your students, with your faculty, with the community? Right. But more generally, as you look at these admission criteria, How do you develop these metrics? How do you know they're working? Where do they come from? How do you modify them? How do you test them?
All of which will be answered when we return in a moment with President Marvin Krislaw from Oberlin College. Bill Russell, thank you for that ability to go away. We'll come right back. Be with us when we return. This is the Paula Gordon Show, conversations with people at the leading edge. Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon, and we are honored and delighted to be with President Marvin Krislaw from Oberlin College. Bill Russell had given you the opportunity to answer all questions metric.
Well, I've been struggling with this for a long time, and why not go straight to somebody who's got the answer?
You know, this is one of the great questions right now in higher education.
Well, it's not just higher education. This goes all the way down.
That's right. And education generally, and the Spellings Commission looked at some of this, and this is a burning...
I don't know who Spellings Commission are.
So Margaret Spellings is the Secretary of Education, and she had a commission that looked at trying to calculate how we are doing in higher education. And when you get into these discussions, of course, there are apples and oranges and pears and bananas, too. So that's part of the challenges. So there are two-year colleges and there are 4 years and there are, you know, some that are more research-oriented and so forth. There's certain metrics that we can all agree are valuable, things like graduation rates. The challenge, though, may be that sometimes in the graduation rates, you don't count people who either transfer in or transfer out and successfully complete. And there may be people that decide midstream that a place is a better fit for them or not than the place they started. You know, most colleges like Oberlin have very high graduation rates, and so the difference between them may not be that high, although some may have slightly lower. One of the things we also try to look at is what happens in those 4 years. So not just whether someone comes out with a degree, but what happens within those 4 or sometimes 5 years, because we have double degree programs for students who are both getting the music degree as well as the liberal arts and sciences degree. But what happens within that period of time? And there are certain things that we might look to, like senior projects, if they can produce a research paper, if they can necessarily create a performance that is at a high level for music. One of the things that Oberlin's very proud of is that we have had a higher number of students go on to graduate programs and earn PhDs than virtually any other institution in America over the past 50 years. And so to the extent one looks at those 4 years and looks at success in going on to get the PhD, Oberlin is very successful.
Part of why I think this is an important subject is that we've gotten, in my opinion, so off track with all this, what I think of as calamitous No Child Left Behind, that when you talk about metrics, people immediately go to the No Child Left Behind and the little kids being stuck with an education that's all directed toward taking tests that has very little to do, as near as I can tell, with education or learning.
Right. But the difference is, I mean, that's correct. The difference to me is you are you sort of have the luxury and in some ways the obligation of doing what primary and secondary schools can't do.
Yeah, but you're upstream from that, and so you're affected by that.
Absolutely, but in terms of development, which is why I'm interested in his perspective. I mean, For all it's easy to criticize, and we do, No Child Left Behind, it comes out of, at least in, for a lot of people, a legitimate concern, which is this metrics question. The problem in local school systems is the politics of it, the economics of it, the cultural. And one of the things that seems to me one of the roles of colleges and universities is to provide that thinking. You've got this pool of smart people who have expertise in relevant subjects, and we would like to be able to look to their colleges and universities to answer these kinds of questions and to do it in the kind of sophisticated way that I think you're talking about.
Well, and one of the things we do try to do is we do invest a lot in the local public schools. We provide instruction in languages, for instance. We have a Spanish language program that goes into the schools. And we have a lot of service learning, and well over half of our students are involved in some sort of volunteer activity, particularly through the schools, but not only through the schools. And I think that we are looking more toward pipeline school projects, because, as you say, colleges and universities do have some expertise in this area. Sometimes it's not as deep, because there may be some connections and disconnections, but I think that colleges and universities are going to be doing more of this, particularly as we realize that K through 12 is not necessarily working the way it should. But it is a problem, and I think, I mean, this is speaking for me, but I think that our society as a whole needs to invest more in K through 12, and that we can't expect colleges and universities, which have some but limited expertise in this area, to be able to save or to improve the K through 12 system on our own, because there are resource issues as well as expertise issues. And I think, we do have a tremendous social challenge ahead of us, and I think that it's important for the government as well as the philanthropic sector and the corporate sector to really think about it. And there's some wonderful examples. The Gates Foundation, obviously, is one that are really trying to address this. But I think the challenges of public education in particular are tremendous and need the best minds.
And one of the challenges I find myself, we're working with people here in Georgia, both in the local schools and the statewide. I find myself at some point coming home and looking in the mirror and said, what is education about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What is the point of educating young people? And there's a certain minimal that you'd like for people to be able to read, which is a challenge,
mm-hmm.
more than I think most of us acknowledge. We'd like for them to be numerate to some degree. We'd at least be able to count to 10 or 20.
The year 2012.
But as you move further up, particularly when you get to colleges and universities, and it's still it's not a small minority, but it's still a minority of the population that goes to college. But all of this process consumes huge resources,
mm-hmm.
and you have to ask yourself why are we doing this? Why are we applying these resources? We've talked about democracy, but there's also a tendency, increasing tendency, to want to businessize schools. To look at it essentially from a purely economic standpoint, that if we invest this money now, then the earning potential over it will be greater than the earning potential. Well, that's interesting, but that's not what a liberal arts education is about.
And it's not what education is about.
Which is the long way around saying or asking, why do we consume all these resources? Have we lost sight of what education's about at each of these levels?
Well, I think partly because we think it teaches you how to think and be creative and analytical, and that's the way that we are going to solve a whole range of issues facing us, whether it's sustainability, whether it's economic distribution, whether it's, an artistic expression, and that ability to think and analyze critically is at the foundation of a liberal arts education. And we want to give students a range of exposures to different disciplines, but also to sharpen some of those skills so that as the world evolves, they will have the ability to grapple with those things.
Well, I think we must make no mistake, there are tremendous challenges ahead. It's not like everything's going to be swell from here on out. When you look at global climate change, when you look at the massive dislocation of people all over the world, there are the teetering condition of many of the developed nations starting with the United States, there are all kinds of things. It's not going to be easy, and we cannot do business as usual. And I go really back to democracy. If we are going to be a self-governing people, that light on the hill that once upon a time we were, if we are going to continue to have a sense of what is important in terms of human rights, in terms of life's rights, other species' rights, all of these are tough questions. And the ability to pass a test isn't what we need from our youngsters.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I've heard it said that, what we are most successful at as a country is actually education, and that that is our greatest export. And if you look at the student bodies on many of our college and universities campuses, they're very diverse. Many international students are coming here. And even into the high school levels, my son's high school has a lot of international students. And I was talking to some high school counselors here, and there are a lot of international students who are coming here. And so it's interesting because there is some concern about China and India are graduating all these people and so forth. But from what I hear, the quality of American higher education is still unsurpassed. And it is in part because of our insistence on broad-based liberal arts education, that we are not as specialized as some of the other nations, and including Western nations. And it is this ability to give people a broad-based education, which really does sharpen, I would argue, the analytical and critical thinking ability, that is what is very distinctive about American education.
There's a twin here. I would argue that America's greatest export is our entertainment.
Well, that.
And if you're looking at the importance of this cultural, well, there are people who call it cultural imperialism. If you're looking at all the stuff that we send out, television and movies, around the world, and you look at our own mass media, that has abysmally failed us in the last 8 years in particular, but simply, I mean, and this is talking about family, the American media has not done its job, at which point education becomes even more important, because if you have dumbing down in the mass media and you've got people who don't know any better, you've got a real problem. Back to John Adams.
It's very funny you mentioned that, because we have a world-class jazz studies program, and we're going to be building a new gold lead certified building for our jazz studies program to give it the kind of shine that
it really President needs. Oberlin College.
Yes. But we're making a bigger point here, which is that as I talk to some of our students who have studied jazz and are very accomplished, they tell me that they're actually more appreciated out of the country than they are in. And that some other countries really appreciate this very indigenous music form that we have, art form that we have in jazz. And there's tremendous interest in music, both jazz and classical, outside of this country. And one of the great things
we're doing. And then there is hip-hop, of course.
Right. Well, you know, that's also, you know, something that is got its own artistic merit. But I think that we are a great exporter of culture. And education, and one of the things that Oberlin we're trying to do is trying to be an international beacon in terms of the arts as well.
We'll be back in just a moment with President Marvin Krisloff, at which point Bill will be able to say what it is that I so rudely cut off. Be with us when we return in a moment. We're back with Marvin Krisloff, who is both attorney Marvin Krisloff and president of Oberlin College. Bill Russell?
You pointed to something about which is the quality of higher education. I sat through last week, 30 or 40 minutes of slides on the basically test results of particularly high school students around about the country, and it's not a pretty picture. There is some good news nominally, and that having taught to the test, some of the test scores are getting better. But as you talk about, I mean, again, this the potential for a serious divide. We still have this, you know, what, 30%, under 30% of Americans go to college, or at least graduate from college.
And you also said that something like 30% of the high school kids are not graduating.
Well, that's one of the dirty little secrets.
Oh.
It's something we don't know.
And even more.
We don't know. That's how bad it is.
Yeah.
I mean, we think it may be 70%. It could be as low as 60%. In Georgia, is at the lower end of some of those scales, but we really do not know.
And we don't talk about it.
But it seems to me that there is a deep peril, even to the universities and colleges. You have this success, but it is built to the outside observer, it looks like quicksand, unless we're... Well, it's interesting. Georgia has done a fairly smart thing. They've outsourced education. We have outsourced education. Atlanta has grown.
It's an insidious smart thing.
Well, I'm not endorsing it, but essentially, Atlanta has grown tremendously. It's one of the most rapid growing, both in terms of people, but also economically. And what we're doing is bringing in people that you've trained.
Mostly
in New York.
Yeah.
We tended to rely heavily on the New York school system, but we're bringing in people to fill the higher paying jobs from functioning school systems, and we have done basically an abysmal job here. And I say that not to pick on Georgia, just because I'm familiar with it, but it seems to me if we don't address this all the way down, the kind of thing you're doing in your local community, but you know, we got to somehow find a way to generalize that. And it seems to me that your peers, as leaders in higher education, have to be deeply concerned about what we're going to do going all the way down to kindergarten.
There is great concern, and I've been part of those discussions, and I can tell you that many colleges and universities are doing a lot of the programs the way I've described them. There are resource problems, and you know, so the question is, do you spend more money focusing on a K-12 enhancement program or a teacher ed program? Or do you provide more international experiences for your students? Or do you provide more research support for your faculty? And there are some colleges and universities that have unlimited resources. That's a very, very few. And Oberlin College, while we're doing very well, does not have the kinds of resources to do whatever we want. And so we do have to make hard choices. But I'm hopeful that the government and the philanthropic sector and the corporate sector will realize that it's important to invest. And what you're talking about is investing in our future. And I the America's Promise, Colin Powell's organization, just recently released this report that showed that the graduation rates in inner city high schools were shocking, particularly in areas like Cleveland and Detroit, some areas that I'm familiar with, well under 50%. And this is just terribly discouraging. And, of course, it's not clear that all of those high school graduates will necessarily have all the skills that they need, but at least that's some sort of a benchmark about what's happening. And it is a very frightening prospect, but I do think that it needs to be addressed on many, many different levels, and that college and university leaders can be voices and leaders, but we have to be joined by other folks if we're going to make this message.
This is everybody's problem.
I'm not a great fan of McKinsey in general. They do some interesting work.
The consulting group.
And they did a study that you're probably familiar with, that, you know, trying to puzzle out how do you address particularly these educational issues in primary and secondary schools. And the conclusion is that it was the core challenge, the difference between success, and they were looking internationally, success and failure, depending on how you define it, was essentially the reputation of the profession, particularly teachers. Was it a respected profession? Was it difficult to get into? Were the standards high? Were they respected in the communities? Were they, you know, were they people that there were held in esteem in the community?
Yes.
And it goes, I think, to what you're saying, but there's a specificity to it that I found useful in that study, that is that until we as a society, a culture, a body politic, or whatever, take education seriously, treat it as if it is a substantive, important, vital, integral part of our well-being, our survival, that everything else is going to be palliative. You're nodding your head.
I'm nodding my head because, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot because I'm going back for my high school reunion this summer, and I actually am working on writing something about some of my high school teachers who were so important to me. And I think about them and I think about what they have done for not only me, but other graduates of my high school, which was a public high school in Lexington, Kentucky. And, you know, you worry that we are not thanking those teachers enough. And you do worry that we're not giving them enough status. God knows we're not giving a lot of money, but it's certainly status and respect to keep them going back year after year, because those jobs are incredibly draining. And if you think about, I teach, but you know, I teach a smaller number, and
you don't do it from 9 to 5 right, every day.
It's not the same. It's
well,
not,
and you picked them.
That's right. Yep.
I mean, you got to select.
Which is different. A public high school teacher takes what comes in the door, and she or he has to work with that, and you know, to turn around someone's life is just the greatest gift, and I do think you're right that part of that must be trying to recruit and retain accomplished individuals. And I have heard anecdotally about there seems to be some movement back. Sometimes people in second careers are going back to teaching high school, and I think Teach for America very interestingly has tapped into this desire to transform the public schools. I worry about how many of those Teach for America graduates actually will end up staying in the schools, and it would be an important question to think about. What can we do to tap into this impulse of idealistic young people to try to take the public schools and really take it into a long-term transformation?
Well, in a way, this goes to what Robert Putnam, I think, was writing about, the engagement.
When he talked about bowling alone.
The engagement in the community. Mm-hmm. And the sense, one, the engagement is if, you know, we are all part of this community and act as if that's the case. And with that as a predicate, then acknowledging, recognizing, understanding how important learning is, not just education, not the narrow sense. Yeah. But that how critical that is to us as in terms of the quality of our individual lives, the lives of our smaller, you know, the community we touch, but the bigger one, the one that we all inhabit up to and including the world.
More learning to happen in just a moment. We'll be back shortly with President Marvin Krisloff for a couple more minutes. Be with us. We have learned and will continue to learn with President Marvin Krisloff from Oberlin College, Bill Russell, and I, Paula Gordon. It's possible that the best thing I have learned in a lifetime, it's not the answers, it's the questions that matter. Isn't that part of what you're saying, Bill, about learning? Isn't that part of what you're saying, President Krisloff?
The engagement, absolutely, absolutely.
It's so tempting to look for the one-handed lawyer, the quick fix, the easy answer. And what do you do to counter that? Because when kids leave a college, or when they leave eighth grade, it isn't Kansas anymore once you get outside.
Well, and I think we do need to set up a system that reinforces that. And so I do think that it's important to say to the students, it's important to the quality of your questions and the quality of the answers that you try to provide is what's important. It's not necessarily getting the right answer. And in my teaching, one of the things I try to do are structure problems that don't have answers. And to say, it's okay if you don't have a clear-cut answer, but it's important for you to show me that you're thinking about it in a methodical way. You're looking at data or evidence or whatever it is that in your discipline, and that you're thinking through those things, and you also can identify how you might further explore it outside of the context of whatever problem or project we're working on. And it's hard because I don't think that we necessarily give that message to young people, and it is a very rush culture, and the pace, I mean, it's very fast. And what we're talking about.
And we're really, really tempted to the easy answers and orthodoxy and the dogmatic.
Well, and it saves time. It saves time. And time is our most valued commodity. But I think it's important for us who are in positions to teach or to inspire to say that it's okay to take a little bit longer, and it's okay to acknowledge difficulty, and it's okay to acknowledge that we don't have it right. And so one of the things I try to do is tell students, I don't know the answer to this, and that's okay. And probably you shouldn't feel that you know the answer either. You should be grappling with it. You should be working at it. I should see you struggling. And that's the way that we show that there's something important going on. You know, I was thinking back to your question earlier about how can we think about it. And I do think there may be an opportunity here to employ some of the senior citizens of this country as well. And, you know, one of the things in Oberlin that I'm very excited about is we have a Kendall, which is a senior living mm-hmm. center. And there are many, many retired professors as well as people who come to the area. And just recently something very nice that happened was some of the seniors at Kendall, retired professors, actually taught in the local high schools. And it was tough. It was tough, and they did a very, very good job. And
tough for whom?
Well, it was tough, I think, for them, because of the length of the day and the kind of work. But I'm told that they did a wonderful job and that the students really appreciated them. And I'm wondering if that may be sort of the next Teach for America type of innovation, to think about having people who've retired, because as we move on as a country, we're going to have more and more retired people. And many of them have very lively minds and are going to want to be doing things, and they may want to do things like this type of a social service project or an educational project. Just, you know, there are constantly ways we have to think about in taking scarce resources and trying to plow them back into our educational system, because I don't think that we can expect that there's going to be a massive infusion of money. And so maybe I'm always looking for new ways to leverage what resources we have and try to plow them back into education.
I'm an engineer. Most problems are soluble.
Yes.
The trick is to collect the a sufficient amount of data, not infinite amounts. You don't need to over research it, but you have to study it, work at it, and then first you have to care. Mm-hmm. First thing is, a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a decision to make the journey. And then the preparation, and then the first step. And I think what you're talking about is all of that has to come together. That rather than, and this is part of the liberal education, it's not just a simple answer.
Absolutely.
But it does require the will.
Thank you for having the will, President Marvin Krisloff. Keep up the good work. More to come.
Thank you.
Education is much too important to be left solely in the hands of professionals. We thank Marvin Krisloff for his openness and for his commitment to improving the quality and impact of education. We thank him for his time and for his friendship. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.